And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined, as always, in Zoom conference by The Athletic's Mets beat writer Tim Britton. And Tim, the Mets have won 5 in a row as we come out of Memorial Day weekend, that time when I have to stop singing the small sample size song and start saying, okay, here's what's happening this season. And what's happening this season, for all of the Mets' injuries and all we've talked about how beat up this team is that they are 6 games above 500. They have a 3.5 game lead over the division. By Baseball Prospectus's Pecota playoff odds, they have a 70% chance of making the postseason. By Fangraph's odds, they have an 84.1% chance of making the postseason. Things, for all the doom and gloom we've spun on this show and probably that has been spun in every tentacle of this Mets monster, things are pretty good.
Yeah, you know, it was last Thursday that I was doing a live Q&A on our website, and like several fans were ready to give up on the season entirely, and one suggested jumping off a cliff of the 2021 baseball season, which seemed premature at that point, considering the team was in first place. They've won 4 straight since then, 5 straight overall, and Monday night in Arizona, you know, as we're all getting used to, well, I shouldn't say we're all, fans are all used to it, as I am getting used to staying up on the East Coast to cover a game on the at West, you know, that was as crisp a game as they've played in a long time, as like encouraging a game going forward as they've played in a long time, because you've got Jacob DeGrom being himself. You had Pete Alonso being himself with 4 RBIs. You had a couple nice at-bats from Francisco Lindor, a couple opposite field doubles from Dominic Smith. There was just a lot to like in that game for the Mets, and a lot to say, okay, this looks more like the team. You know, they've been in first place until this point, but this looked more like the team that you thought they might be if they were in first place. A team that, you know, scored some runs, got some extra base hits, shut you down as a pitching staff. It was an all-around kind of win that they haven't necessarily had in a while outside of, you know, Saturday against Atlanta.
And that's not to mention a rare and welcome laugher of a game on Sunday night, winning 13-2. And you mentioned the contributions from Alonso, from Lindor on Monday night's game, but I'm sorry, I said Sunday. It was Saturday's game. They've had so many rainouts that it's hard to keep track. But James McCann's bat starting to come around, signs of life really all across this Mets team. You mentioned Alonso, who's now back in the lineup. Seth Lugo back as well. We haven't seen him yet, but it feels like this is a team that hopefully is positioned to avoid the type of June that has befallen it in recent seasons.
Yeah, I don't know the last time I meant to actually look this up, the last time they had a winning record in June. You know, since I've been on the beat, you know, I started in 2018, you know, that was the year they went 5-21 in June, which was their worst record in any month since 1982. 1982, they went 5-24 in August, which is actually what the Diamondbacks just did in the month of May. And then in 2019, I think they were 10-18 in June. 2020, they didn't win any games in June. So, that has been the month that has hurt them the most. And there's no specific reason why it should be June. They've had some injuries and some lack of depth showing up in that month. This year, you know, you've got the schedule. The first half of June gets a little bit tougher after these 2 remaining games in Phoenix, because you've got the Padres for a 4-game series this weekend, and then a 3-game series the weekend after that. And then a four game series at home against the Cubs after you play San Diego the second time. So that's, you know, that's 11 games against teams over 500 and comfortably over 500 at the moment in the next 15 that they're playing. And they've only played 12 games against teams over 500 so far this season, of which they've only won two. So they haven't been tested by really good baseball teams yet, or they haven't passed tests against really good baseball teams. They got swept by Tampa Bay. They got swept by Boston over two games. They got swept by the Cubs for three in Chicago. So they've struggled in those contests so far. And then the second half of June, you just got a lot of games. You know, they play 33 games in 31 days from like June 11th to July 11th, I believe, and the All-Star break because of all the doubleheaders, three doubleheaders in 1 week against three different teams, which means that the other teams don't have all of the doubleheaders that they have to worry about. So those will be, you know, as good as it feels for the Mets on the morning of June 1st, there are some concerns going forward about what might go wrong over the next 30 days.
We have made it a full 5 minutes into this episode and not really discussed the return of Jacob deGrom, who we've seen once and spoken about it, but in Monday night's game, I think you could almost hear Luis Rojas's sigh of relief at that first hit, because deGrom had perfect game stuff and you knew he was going to be a little bit limited coming off that injury. And so it puts Rojas in a bad spot there if deGrom is still perfect when he gets up to around his pitch count.
Yeah, they had talked about six innings or 85 pitches for deGrom in this one, with the idea, you know, he'd pitched five and 63 pitches, I think, last time. So they kind of wanted to slowly build him coming back from the back soreness, the lat soreness. And, you know, next start, he might be all full go, though, you know, we'll get to that point in 5 days. But he did look, you know, the first three innings, he's just slicing through everyone. I think it was 34 pitches for nine up, nine down. And then he fell behind Josh Rojas 3-0 to start the fourth. And I thought, like, this is it. This is going to be like the walk. And then he'll get the next 18 guys out. But you know, he got through the fourth, but then gave up the Carson Kelly line drive base hit in the fifth, and then the other one that Billy McKinney probably should have caught in right field. But it does seem like, you know, with the way I think even if there hadn't been six plus an asterisk no hitters in Major League Baseball this year, you would think watching DeGrom every time out that there is a chance he does that, because of how dominant he looks for long stretches of baseball games, where he has a lot of 1-2-3 innings where it doesn't seem like anything is hit hard enough to like be a hit. Like last night, you know, it's a bunch of strikeouts and groundouts. There wasn't a ball hit to the outfield until the fifth inning. He's retiring the side in more than 60% of his innings. I think it's 31 out of 51 so far. So it's really just it feels like it's inevitable that he will eventually throw a no-hitter, but I don't know if it happens this season or next season, or, you know, when he's 42 and throwing 110 miles an hour.
Yeah, I think a no-hitter is selling it short. I think he's got to throw a prayer. Like, I wouldn't even be that impressed if Jacob deGrom threw a no-hitter at this one, because, I mean, he walked someone or someone reached base on error. That's not what I'm in it for. Like, he's going to throw a perfect game.
Yeah, I mean, that's
it's never felt like something you could predict before, right, where you could be like, ah, this guy's going to throw a perfect game this year. But, like, Jacob deGrom's going to throw a perfect game this year.
Like, I think we've talked about on this before, the Roy Halladay playoff game no-hitter against the Reds is the only no-hitter I've covered. And being there and thinking, like, by the third inning that this was going to mm-hmm. be a perfect game. And he walked, I think it was Jay Bruce in the fifth inning of that game. And it was just kind of like, oh, so it'll just be a no-hitter then. Okay. And that's the feeling you get watching DeGrom often, is that, like, how is someone going to get a hit off of this? It's really just like they've got to speed up their bat and catch up to a fastball and hit it hard where someone isn't, which doesn't happen very often.
Another guy returning from a similar injury and a short DL stint that has been great. Not quite Jacob deGrom great, but who is Taijuan Walker with another really good, albeit short, start in making his return. As thin as the Mets starting pitching is stretched right now with Syndergaard out, not indefinitely, but for the bulk of the season with Carlos Carrasco nowhere to be seen. We know, you know, they don't have a lot of wiggle room in the rotation, but that front three of DeGrom, Walker, and Marcus Stroman have really, I think, done probably the lion's share in putting the Mets where they are at this point in the season.
Yeah, I mean, Walker's ERA is down below two now at 1.84, so his WHIP is below one. As I'm looking at his baseball reference page, it's remarkable how good those three guys have been. You know, Peterson has been not quite as good this year as he was last year. He's been more up and down. He's had some rough innings that have gotten away from him. But Stroman, DeGrom, and Walker have looked every bit as good as you could have hoped for when, like, you know, if this were DeGrom, Carrasco, and Syndergaard doing this, you wouldn't expect them to be this good, you know. So that's what's been so encouraging from their starting staff. Their starting rotation ERA is it might be now be the best in baseball. I haven't checked that in the last couple of days, but it's under three as a staff. It's 2.81 or something going into DeGrom's start on Monday. So they're getting great starting pitching, and they're you know. Those guys, maybe with the exception of Walker coming back, and I guess DeGrom coming back from the injury, they're going deep into games with mm-hmm. consistency. You know, Stroman feels like he's rolling out of bed and giving you six innings. DeGrom is pitching so efficiently this year. You know, Steve Gelbs talked on the broadcast last night about how he's leading the league in pitches per inning. He's down to like 13.4 pitches per inning after being at 16.7 last year.
Despite striking everybody out. It's not like he's just getting ground balls. Yeah.
He's striking everybody out in three pitches because no one can foul off the fastball the way they did last year. And Walker's given them some 6 and 7 inning outings, even though I think his average per start is like 5.5. That's been affected by some of the a couple short ones where he's left in the fourth or fifth inning, but they're getting length from those guys, which means, you know, on most nights when they pitch, it's DeGrom to Miguel Castro and Trevor May and Edwin Diaz. You're using your good bullpen guys behind them, and those guys are performing. We're not seeing guys blow games behind Jacob DeGrom the same way they might have in years past.
Yeah, and I would say the bullpen, you know, outside of the existential spate of injuries, the bullpen has to qualify as the biggest surprise for the Mets this season to date. Really up and down. Right now, the only guy with an ERA over 3.38 in their active bullpen is Jacob Barnes, who has himself been a lot better. He had a few real rough outings early on, and he's been a lot better. But a curious move in that bullpen upon the return of Seth Lugo, who, again, we still haven't seen, was that they sent a guy I've become a pretty big fan of, Sean Reed Foley, down to the minors. Do you think that's a matter of just, like, bullpen logistics? He had thrown 2 1/3 innings the day or 2 days before they sent him down. With a guy like that, I don't know that how long that sets him back. Like, maybe you have one more day you're laying off of him. Is it just a matter of who has options? Like, why is that guy with a 1.98 ERA, albeit only in 13 and two-thirds innings, why is he the one to go?
Yeah, I think that's probably a matter of options, right? Because Barnes is the guy that like you said, has probably been the only one in that bullpen who hasn't been really lights out so far this year, and he doesn't have options. You expose him, you send him down, you expose him to waivers, he probably gets claimed. And we know with all of the injuries that they have had, that they could use retaining some depth. So, that's why, I think they sent Reed Foley down. You know, like, you look at the rest of the cast, you know, you're not going to send Diaz, Castro, May, Familiar, or Loop down. You don't want to send Barnes down. So it's really came down to Reed Foley, Robert Gazelman, or Drew Smith. And all of those guys have pitched really well. You know, Reed Foley kind of by the nature of being the last, you know, it's kind of the, last one in, first one out, I guess, part of that bullpen that he gets sent down. And, you know, we'll see how they use Seth Lugo. That's something that really interests me, is whether they use him. You know, in the past, they've used him like whatever emergency situation they needed him for, which was, you know, first a setup man, then a closer, then a starter. And we'll see, you know, if they've got kind of the foundation around him, can they use Seth Lugo the best way to use Seth Lugo versus the thing this team needs right now? And I've always felt that's like pitching him for two innings every third day or something like that. So I'm eager to see how the Mets deploy him. Maybe not right away because they'll probably try to ease him in a little bit. But you know, once he gets his feet on the ground and looks like Seth Lugo, how often they use him and for how long they use him.
With Reed Foley, and I'm putting you on the spot here because I don't know the answer here, but it was something that we discussed on the most recent show, thanks to a reader question. And I mentioned, you know, how thin the starting pitching has been stretched. Do you think that there's a chance that in AAA they look to stretch him out as a starter, given that that seems like the most pressing potential need?
Maybe they stretch him out a little bit more. I don't think, you know, we always talk about with Lugo, you know, are they going to stretch him out as a starter? I don't think with those guys, and even with guys who are, you know, who have pitched as starters for the Mets this year, Lucchesi and Jordan Yamamoto among them, I don't think they're thinking along the same lines of like, well, he's either going to be a one or two inning reliever for us, or he's going to be a six or seven inning starter. I think they're looking at kind of that space in between, which is like, the guy who throws maybe four innings. We're happy if we get four out of him. You know, Reed Foley has done that to three innings on a few occasions for the Mets. So maybe they try to get like an additional fourth inning out of him. But I don't think it's why don't you go down to AAA and learn how to throw a full six innings again. I think, you know, given the depth of their bullpen, that they're getting contributions really 1 through 8, really 1 through 12. In their bullpen, the guys who have been going back and forth, like Reed Foley, have been really good for them. They've pitched to an ERA under 3 this year, guys who spent time in the minors and majors in their bullpen. You know, I think they just want like some bulk innings from those guys, but you don't have to get them to the late game guys. You know, if Lucchesi can throw 4 good innings, keep you in the game, and then you can go to Gazelman for the 5th and 6th, and then you get into the late inning guys, or go to Drew Smith for a couple innings. I think that's kind of the formula they see for themselves in the like 5th, 6th, and 7th starter spots that they'll probably have to end up using with the doubleheaders later in the month.
And that's a luxury you get from having that strong trio at the front of the rotation, especially Stroman and DeGrom, who have been working so deep into games, because then it takes, you're not going to have to use Drew Smith for 2 innings after Stroman or after DeGrom. And so, you get a couple of built-in days off for those more like bulky innings type guys in the bullpen. And that allows you, I think, to be a little more flexible with backing up Lucchesi or Peterson, or, if the time comes, Zupacki or Reed Foley, whoever else is in the back end of that rotation. But let's flip over to the offensive side. Because we still have, and we mentioned the bats starting to come around. Pete Alonso looking good. He said he feels like Pete, which is a good thing to hear. Obviously, you know, we keep talking about Jonathan Villar and Jose Peraza and Tomas Nito and the contributions they've made from that bench mob, now the most of the lineup mob. But we've got Jeff McNeil, Michael Conforto, Brandon Nimmo, J.D. Davis, Luis Guillorme, Albert Almora, Dineshri Fargas, all still on the disabled list. Who do we see first? When are, because it seems like we just keep, it seems Nimmo, we thought would be back in 10 days, a month and a half ago. When is more of the cavalry returning?
Yeah. So I think Guillorme is probably going to go out on a rehab assignment this week. So he might be the first of those back. Almora could start a rehab assignment this week. So he'd come back after that. Those are probably the guys you're less excited to hear. I mean, they would be helpful, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But, they're not guys who are in the opening day lineup. McNeil and Conforto, they're kind of in a holding pattern with their hamstring strains. It's probably another month or close to it until we see them. So those are the big losses for them right now. J.D. Davis is closer to a rehab assignment than Brandon Nimmo. There had been... You know, I did not, I was not covering the weekend game against the Braves. So there had been some talk about, you know, Davis potentially starting a rehab assignment as soon as today, Tuesday, with Syracuse. That's not happening. They haven't set a time frame for when that might happen for him, whether it's, you know, they haven't been as firm in saying like that should start this week with Davis as they have been with Guillorme. And then Nimmo is still waiting for that pain to subside in his finger because of the nerve issue. Again, all words that don't sound great. So, they're again, like, just kind of waiting to see how that plays out. But at least you've got Alonso back in the middle of that order to give you, like, you know, they've had for the last several weeks, like, a bunch of really good, you know, their usual players, usual starters have been left-handed hitters, and then kind of filling out the lineup with some righties in the back half. Now you've got Alonso as a middle of the order right-handed hitter that they haven't had, but, you know, why we were seeing guys like James McCann and Tomas Nito hitting third, fourth, fifth for them for a little while. It's nice to have Alonso back in that spot, knocking in runs the way he did on Monday night.
And not quite a middle of the order type guy, but also Kevin Pillar, very much making himself a hero, returning already from the multiple facial fractures he suffered on that gruesome hit by pitch. Good to see him back with a pinch hit single in Monday night's game, and good to see another credible major leaguer that they can run out in center field, because they sort of ran short on those.
Yeah, you know, that was the biggest void in the lineup recently was center field with Cameron Maben struggling the way he did with the team. They call up Mason Williams, who had been raking in AAA and looked good last night, Monday night at the plate and in the field, making a terrific catch in center field on, I think, a Domingo Leyba fly ball. And then Pillar comes in a double switch and gets a hit in his first at bat. I think it's remarkable with him, because you look back at the time he was hit in the chin when he was with the Giants, and then he hit like 400 for the next week. Didn't miss any time that time. And you always think, like, you know, when a guy gets hit up there, there's going to be like a week where, you know, the first week be back
terrified.
Playing,
don't I would. Could you imagine? Could you imagine standing in the batter's box after that's happened to you? I can't. It's like impossible to process how someone's mind could allow them to just stand there. Like, I would just, I don't know. I think I would be done forever. I don't think I could ever play baseball again.
And he's playing, you know, he played left field the last couple innings last night with a protective mask on. That one, the one he's wearing currently, is not custom fit. That's kind of like a store-bought one. Mm-hmm. So they're going to get him a custom fit one. I think there was one ball, it seemed like, that snuck by him. It was one that I don't think he would have caught under normal circumstances, but maybe. But he didn't look 100% comfortable going after it. The way the mask, he's not wearing it while he's batting because of the way it cuts into his peripheral vision. I'm not sure how that affects him fielding. It seemed like it affected him a little bit on Monday, but we'll see when he gets back into the starting lineup. I thought it was a little strange that they activated him at a time where he said he was still working through a few things, you know, because of the rain over the weekend. He didn't get a chance to test out that mask while, like, you know, shagging fly balls during batting practice or something like that. But he was able to do that on Monday. And, the team clearly viewed that as a lift. You had post-game Alonso and DeGrom speaking very earnestly about what it meant to see Kevin Pillar back, let alone back playing and getting a base hit for them, that this is the kind of veteran that has come in and made a presence with himself in the clubhouse in a good way for the Mets.
Maybe that custom mask will be like one of the old timey, like, plague masks, like one of the big beaks, like an Eyes Wide Shut or something like that. For the moment, at least, we can speculate about that. Perhaps a mask with the image of his unfractured face on it, so like he's just wearing a mask of his own face. That might be interesting. I said that he pinch hit incorrectly. You corrected me. Thank you. It was a double switch. I was long asleep at that point. I lasted until DeGrom let up the hit, because I wasn't going to sleep before that. And I think I made it an inning or two after that. But West Coast games, when you've got two tiny children, difficult to get all the way through without passing out.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We got a good question from a reader, and this one's for you more than it's for me, for sure. Matt wants to know, he says, I just finished reading The Worst Team Money Could Buy by John Harper and Bob Clappish about the train wreck of a 1992 season, which I remember very well. Beyond the combustible nature of the team, both on and off the field, one of the storylines I found most intriguing was the ins and outs of being a Mets beat writer. Seemed like there were about six guys who covered the team day to day and travel with the team. They do short bios on all of them toward the beginning of the book. Before the pandemic, what had that staple of beat writers ballooned to, and were there writers that still traveled on team charters? How has the dynamic between players and writers changed since the book was written? And he has got more questions too that I can follow up with. But you were not on the beat in 1992 because you were a child. So I know you can't speak to that, but give Matt a little information. What is the dynamic, I guess, the pre-pandemic and current dynamic of being a Mets beat writer?
Yeah, so I read that book last year, and I really liked it. You know, it's one of those books that you know about for a while, and I finally decided to pay, you know, $10 for it and read it last June when I was reading every book I could get my hands on because there was nothing else to do. And the thing that really did strike me about it was like the intimacy of the relationship that Harper and mm-hmm. Clappish had with several players, like that they knew them in a way that I've never known any player. That, you know, they're going out with them after games, they're playing pickup basketball with David Cone in the morning in Pittsburgh or something, and they just have a relationship that I think is really hard for beat writers to have in the current state of things. Like I was never, I've been a beat writer in the majors since 2011. I was never on a team plane. I don't know. I've never worked with a writer who in that time has been on a team plane. I think there have been some writers in other markets, smaller markets, where there have been kind of emergency situations where they fly on the team plane, but it's not something that happens regularly for anyone who covers Major League Baseball as a beat writer anymore. The TV guys and the radio guys are on the plane, so that's one difference, that they get a little bit better relationship at times, or in some notable instances a much worse relationship mm-hmm. because they're on the team plane. So you know, that's how that works with travel. We're just flying commercial.
Yeah, my understanding on that is that what changed, and I think it's, you know, it's clear to me that it's a far more professional arrangement for a beat writer to not be traveling on the team charter. But I think at least by my understanding, what catalyzed that change was just the rise of airline points and miles and you know, writers traveling so often that they didn't really want to tank airline miles by flying on a charter when they could be flying Delta and then get themselves a nice vacation after the season's over.
See, I don't know. I always assumed that the teams just kicked us off because that would, you know,
that would also make sense. Yeah.
They do. And I, for one, you know, having flown a lot of like 7:30 a.m. flights out of Logan and LaGuardia in my time, would prefer the amenities of a charter flight.
I know for sure that back during in the postseason a long time ago, that there used to just be a Baseball Writers of America charter flight, and so like between World Series, in the between legs of the World Series, all of the writers would just get on the writer charter rather than flying individually. And that was definitely, I think, the airline miles that did that in. It was that people didn't want to pay the money for the team charter, for the writer charter, and not wind up getting anything for themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, like this is a topic of conversation, not just in baseball, but in sports with Naomi Osaka and the French Open. Like, you know, especially in the current access regulations, where everything is on Zoom and just about mm-hmm. everything is a group interview and everything is a televisable group interview, it's really not a plus for anyone. You know, players get kind of the more banal questions that lead to cliches. They get
they roll their eyes.
Well, because if you're working on something, if you're working on something unique or unusual, then if you ask that question of, first of all, it's very like, you know, like I used to always want to know guys, like I'm not going to in a post game interview be like, hey, by the way, what's your favorite sandwich? Like, sorry about the facial fractures, but we got to know, what sandwich are you eating when you get home, Kevin Pillar? Right? Like, you're not going to ask the dumb questions, which sometimes lead to good answers. And you're not going to, like, I don't think you're going to want to, and you could, I'm putting words in your mouth here, but I almost feel like you don't really want to scoop yourself by asking questions that are going to then seed answers that everyone will use to write the same column as you.
Yeah, and that you've got to try to like sneak in those questions, you know. And it was funny in spring training, talking with some of the other beat writers, like, you know, you knew the story that someone else was working on because, oh, like in my case, I was going to write a story about their outfield defense, and we had Brandon Nimmo one day, so I asked him about, you know, working with Tony Tarasco, and then we had Dom Smith 3 days later, and I asked him the same thing. Then we had Conforto a day after that, and I asked him the same thing, and I'm being made fun of, like, when's that Tony Tarasco story yeah. coming out? Yeah, you know that's what I'm working on at in that point. And like you go back to the playoffs last year, it was Walker Buehler who got asked about like the tightness of his pants being
and he said like
a thing on Twitter
right.
After a World Series game in
after a loss, press conference, right? Didn't he lose?
And Buehler just saying like not the time or place, which is true. That is not the time or place. The problem is there is no other time or place for questions like that, like more casual, lighthearted questions. I think, you know, this happens more often in the NBA now, like the playoff podium becomes becomes like a power dynamic between player and reporter. We don't get that as much on Zoom, but there it's still, you know, I've covered baseball where not every managerial press conference was not every managerial interaction was a press conference,
mm-hmm.
And they weren't all immediately on television.
Right.
And that was always like a much easier dynamic with a manager where you can say like, hey, you know, why did you do this strategic move without him feeling like he's being put on the spot and like you're trying to embarrass him publicly or something.
Right.
Like that.
Which
you
is
can have a detailed conversation about the strategy behind something. And you can throw out, oh, well, I might have done this. You can go back and forth and it's not necessarily contentious in a way that it would be if it were happening in front of the rest of the media and the entire fan base.
You don't get sunned on TV by Willie Randolph the first time you ever work up the courage to ask a question in a post-game press conference. I've never been on a beat, but just from observing the Mets clubhouse, I've spent a lot of time in the Mets and Yankees clubhouses and a lot of time in visiting clubhouses, time in clubhouses on the road, and we've discussed it like, there are just so many members of the media. When the clubhouse is open, you often get like 40 members of the media, and there's only three or four guys at their lockers, even like that you would talk to. It's a difficult, you know, and no one wants to. I think I can complain about this because I'm not working in the industry right now. Other, you know, but no one wants to hear it. It's difficult to get those scoops, those exclusives. I think that beat writers might get on the road, really, and in the pre-pandemic times, it's in a Mets clubhouse, in a Yankees clubhouse. If you're a stranger, which I always was, I found it very it's very difficult to have like really a meaningful conversation with someone beyond those like sort of standards and cliches, because something that's happened to me, and it's really weird, is like, in the few times that I did work up the courage to like, let me try to talk to this guy and just like not be recording and maybe see if I can develop a relationship here. What happens is someone you don't know from the media will just sort of swoop in and stick a microphone out and join in on your conversation. And it's very awkward. Like, it's very weird when you're just like, you know, shooting the breeze with someone or attempting to, and then someone else comes in, like, because everyone's different when they're being recorded. And so someone else comes in with a recorder, and then the whole dynamic of that conversation changes. And so, you know, I'm not someone who I think is terribly good at developing relationships with strangers anyway. And so I always found that like a huge challenge. Like I just felt like I'm never going to be able to get stories the way a beat writer can, because I'm not on the road with team. And so I have to imagine not being on the road for you has been a huge challenge these past couple of years.
Yeah, the road is where you really, you know, develop those relationships, where you go from the 3 or 4 dozen reporters who are there at home to, you know, 6 to 8. I think the question asks how many guys are traveling with the team. I think it's how many people are traveling with the team as beat writers. I believe it's 6 because you've got Newsday, the Daily News, the Post, the Athletic, MLB.com, the Record. I think that's it.
The Times isn't.
The Times does not. They don't have a regular beat writer on the team. They haven't since James Wagner moved after the 2018 season. You know, those are the people. You know, if you're under normal circumstances in the clubhouse in Arizona later this afternoon on Tuesday, you know, they'll probably be like maybe 10 people in there, because there might be a couple Arizona reporters who sneak in to try to do something. You know, that's what hasn't been there. You know, even traveling under, you know, the people, I'm not in Arizona, some of the other reporters are, even out there, I don't, you know, I'm not sure if they're getting anything that I'm not by being there. Certainly like the environment of the game, but in terms of access, nothing at the moment, although that I believe is supposed to be changing in Major League Baseball relatively soon, in terms of being able to be on the field for batting practice and talk to players in interview setting face to face. That hasn't had to be prearranged with the PR staff, where you can just kind of grab a guy and say, "Hey, do you have a minute?" And ask him the kinds of questions that you would usually ask in the clubhouse setting. So that would be a really big step forward, really help in a lot of ways, because there's just so many like little observations you make over the course of a game, or little follow-ups you want to ask that don't work for a press conference setting and are not important enough to like arrange an entire phone call around. Like there's been something I've wanted to ask Trevor May about since April. And there just hasn't been enough, you know, I need like 8 other things to ask him about in order to justify setting up a long phone call with him to take time out of his day. And I haven't had the other, you know, I've got like 4 other things now, but I need, not at the 8 other things.
Got to fill it up. Yeah. Well, we can work on that. We can come up with more questions for Trevor May. But Matt had a second question in his email, which was, again, related to the worst team money could buy. He wants to know, what are your favorite books about the Mets?
That's up there. That's funny because it's, you know, as a Mets fan, I'm not sure whether you love that or hate that, depending on what you experienced in 1992. But I thought it was really interesting to get, you know, I was taken aback by the candor that Harper and Klapisch had about like what it was like to cover certain players, you know, how much they enjoyed hanging out with David Cone, how much they disliked Jesse Orozco, which I didn't know, that he was not, he was a particularly difficult member of the team to deal with as a media member. I love Can't Anybody Here Play This Game by Jimmy Breslin, which I read last year as well. About the 1962 Mets, just full of great stories. Those are probably the two that stand out. I have a bunch about the 69 team that I haven't read yet, because you know, once they won, there were a lot of books written about them. I bought a bunch of them last year, but I haven't gotten around to reading them yet. I haven't read Bill Madden's Tom Seaver biography yet. That's kind of on my next to do bookshelf. So I'm trying to think if there's anything I'm missing in terms of Mets books. I haven't read Devin Gordon's new book, So Many Ways to Lose. We did the interview with Mike Puma. I liked that book, If These Walls Could Talk. So there's no shortage of good Mets literature out there. And I encourage everyone to explore every aspect of it.
Yeah, The Bad Guys Won is another one. Jeff Perlman's book, which I think is a bit of a classic about the 1986 Mets, and one I really enjoyed. I am very bad about reading nonfiction books in general, and especially baseball books. I don't know. It's just having been it feels like a little bit of a, I guess you could look at it as this is work and you should do more work, or you could say like, well, that's a busman's holiday, right? Like, I'm already spending a lot of my time writing about baseball and going to baseball games and spending a lot of my free time going to baseball games on top of that. Like, when I'm going to read, I'm going to find something else to read about most of the time. So I'm sort of embarrassingly poorly read in terms of, especially Mets books. I've read more probably like national baseball classics than Mets books specifically. Although I will say I do remember reading a Lenny Dykstra autobiography at a very young age, and I should not have done that. That was like on that and Bo Jackson's autobiography, which I read when I was like 7 years old. And I just like, someone should have screened that for me. Like, no one should have allowed a 7 year old or an 8 year old or whatever, however old I was when it came out, to read about Bo Jackson's college sex life, which was detailed in that book. If you have a question for the podcast, please send it along. You can email as Matt did at asktedberg@gmail.com, or you could hit us up on Twitter. Tim is at Tim Britton. I am at OG Ted Berg. Tim, you mentioned they've got two more with the Diamondbacks, and then a much tougher schedule following that. And we, as always, will be back to talk about it.
Adios.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.